Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Welcome everyone to another hot stove edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball. Terry Cushman here with you tonight. Joining me is Cody Paulson. The two of us are going to tag team this episode. The news of the day: James Paxton has exercised his $4 million player option, so it was on him if he wanted to exercise that. He would basically at least put himself on the 40-man roster to start the hot stove season. You can't really rule out a trade necessarily, not saying it's going to happen, but there are some scenarios that might not have him on the roster opening day. But we're going to be talking about him, how he fits into the rotation, what it all means. We might talk a little bit of bullpen because there was some Whitlock and Houck comments today. And then we will get to some comments from Scott Boris on Xander Bogaerts' market. So somewhat of a loaded show, and we'll get into it. How are you, Cody? I think it's been a few since you've been on.
It's been a little while. Good to be back. Good to talk to the team here. Things have been going well. Just had a little bit of travel that I had to take care of, some weddings to attend to. So I appreciate you all being flexible. Happy to see everybody. How are you doing, Terry?
I'm doing all right. I told you a few minutes ago, going to Baltimore this weekend for a cribbage tournament. That's my nerdy hobby. I've said that a few times on the podcast, and I'm on a roll though. I won like $2,200 in July, which isn't bad. And then I won about $1,300 this time, but it was only in one tournament versus I think I was in 5 in July. So I'm on my own little hot streak there, and got one of those this weekend. So looking forward
to keep it rolling. Best of luck, man.
Yeah, hopefully. I've played in Baltimore once, and I really messed up what ended up being the final hand of the qualifying round, and I missed the playoffs, and it's haunted me. That was probably in 2014, 2015. So it's kind of like when Eckersley gives up the World Series in 88, I think it was, to the Dodgers. You know, like that was probably obviously way more, you know, traumatic, but it's a similar thing. You just remember that one game out of the thousands I've played, you know what I mean? So, yeah. And all right. So yeah, how many weddings was it? Like every time we text you, you're like, yeah, I'm on a plane or something.
It's been crazy. I think we've been to 3 weddings in the last 30 days, none of which have been, you know, in the town that I live in. Obviously, you know, super honored to be invited to be a part of people's special day. But it's been a lot. It was the last one of the season for us. So, you know, we'll definitely be a little bit more present moving forward.
Were you in any of the weddings? Like, were you a groomsman or anything like that?
I was in like the proceedings for two of them, but I wasn't a groomsman for any of them.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
So we had to be there for like rehearsals and you know, I had a part in the big day, but not necessarily up there as a part of the party.
Yeah. One of my best friends, I was a groomsman and I wasn't expecting to be. And I was really upset if they were going to make me wear a bow tie. I didn't want to wear a bow tie. And so,
oh, yeah?
So the bride to be was like, oh, he can wear whatever he wants. And I'm like, okay, regular necktie with a half Windsor. Cause that's all I know how to tie. Yeah. And I missed the rehearsals and they come up to me and they're like, I can hear the wedding director, you know, talking to the other people. And then he comes up to me, he's like, Terry. And he claps his hands, he's rubbing them. And I'm like, whatever you're about to tell me, I'm hearing it for the first time. And,
oh man,
it ended up being fine. But yeah, I hate weddings though. You know, so I'm like the least saddest person ever if I'm not invited, if it ends up being a small ceremony or whatever. Totally good to, you know, sit that one out. But I'm just not as social or whatever. And I hate dressing up. I hate dressing up with a passion. So anyway.
That's a pretty big deterrent to a wedding.
Yeah. And the thing I learned when I was the groomsman was you want to get your tux at least a couple weeks out. And I was like 4 days. So I was insanely lucky that it all worked out. I had no idea, you know. I'm used to just wearing, you know, khakis and just a button down shirt, untucked, you know. And yeah. So, yeah, it all worked out, though. And I didn't have to wear the damn bow tie either. I would, if anyone ever took a picture of me wearing one, I would like, that would be traumatic for me. Anyway, all right, so let's get into some Red Sox here. So, what are your thoughts on the Paxton signing? I kind of thought it was inevitable myself because he's just a huge unknown right now. And, you know, $4 million is kind of a lot, you know, for a team to pay more than that. You know, they're taking a big risk. So what were your thoughts as the news broke?
Yeah, I mean, it did kind of seem inevitable. I think he kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier, you know, once we declined that $13 million, you know, knowing that there was the tacked on $4 million player option, he'd be silly not to take it, right? We're kind of in the same place that we were with him last year. You know, anything that we get out of him for the season, I think is a bonus. You know, obviously at the $4 million price tag is a little bit different than 13, but you know, this is a guy that has top of the rotation stuff if he's healthy, and that's kind of been the biggest hullabaloo about him. You know, he's had lower body injuries, he's had, you know, left forearm strain, he's had the, you know, the Tommy John, obviously. So it's going to be a road back for him. But you know, he's pitched well in postseason. I think he's won, you know, 60% of his starts. The only thing I would say is a negative is just, it feels like we're kind of doing the same dance that we did last year in the offseason, where we're kind of saying like, okay, you know, if all these dominoes fall correctly, we're going to be in pretty good shape. And that's a dangerous game to play in baseball. You know, it's an oblique strain here. It's a dead arm sensation there. And then, you know, you never see that guy again. And, you know, I don't think there's going to be top of the line, you know, 2-3 starter value out there, especially at that $4 million price tag. So, you know, you're trying to put lipstick on a pig at this point. You know, I don't think I'm necessarily the most upset with it, just because if he does come back and he is right, or, you know, any version of himself that we've seen in the past, it's going to smell like roses. And so I'm just going to be optimistic and hope that, you know, we can get a solid back half of the season from him at the very least.
I would be fine with the deal if we had a solid rotation in place to begin with. And we'll get to the rotation here in a little bit, but there's a lot of concerns, and you've also got Chris Sale in there. How many innings are you getting out of him? You know, I jokingly said, what if he forgets how to walk, you know, like he forgot how to ride a bike. It's just, there's a ton of risk in this rotation. And Paxton is, let me see here, 3 days ago he turned 34, so next year is essentially his age 34 season. only four times has he pitched more than 100 innings. And his max was in 2018 at 160 innings. So this is a guy who has had, like you said, a litany of different injuries here. And people can say, well, he's got a fully built, rebuilt elbow. That's great. Well, it is. But like I said in the last show, how's that 34-year-old shoulder going to hold up that hasn't had a normal workload in almost, what, 4 years? You know, 2019 was his last full season, and he pitched, I think, 150 innings there. The other thing, too, is not quite to the, you know, extreme degree of Nick Pivetta, but Paxton at times can lose his mechanics, and he just kind of goes on a rough stretch. So we're going to be dealing with that. We're going to be dealing probably with some, you know, aches and pains and the wear and tear that a 34-year-old pitcher will go through. So I can't help but be a pessimist about it. The line Scott Boris gave was hilarious. Boris says something to the effect of, it wasn't about the money in this situation. It was about his comfort level with, you know, the Red Sox. I'm like, what comfort level? He's never pitched an inning here. I mean, he obviously knows the medical staff well by now, because, you know, they were trying. I mean, the expectation in 2022 was that he was going to join the rotation about halfway through the season. And he had some really glowing reports with him in like April and May. They're like, he is throwing really hard. He's ahead of schedule. And then he had some setbacks and then never pitched. So it's just a huge mystery right now. But with that Boris line, I just said, you know, it's not about the money. It was more about the comfort. When do you ever hear Boris say, yeah, he didn't have a market, so he had to take it? Because that's, I think, what happened here. I think Boris assessed the market, talked to some teams, and they're like, you know, we don't really want to take on that risk. So
that's a great comment too, right? Like, Boris is perhaps, you know, the puppeteer of all puppeteers, right? You know, he's the guy shopping his players, trying to find the best deal for him. And, you know, for Boris to kind of take the wind out of those sails, I think says a lot. And, you know, one thing I will say as of note to kind of the statistics that you mentioned, this guy hasn't had an ERA above four whenever he's finished a season, right? If he's pitched, you know, a full slate of games, we'll call it, you know, his highest ERA is 3.82, and he went 15-6 that year. So the guy keeps the ball in the yard. He, you know, he kind of keeps you in games. I absolutely agree with you. You know, when he's not humming, it does look bad. It is Pivetta-esque in the sense of losing your mechanics. But, you know, if we weren't relying on trying to find five starters to go every fifth day, I think this looks a lot better. But it does put a little bit more pressure on him to kind of come back and be the big game pitcher that he can be or has been in the past.
As I've pointed out several times, nobody eviscerated the Michael Wacha deal last winter worse than I did. I hated it. I wanted nothing to do with it. And it just had like Garrett Richards written all over it to me, you know, reclamation project that just didn't work out. And I was wrong about that. So if that ends up being the case this season, I'll gladly own it. I don't hate Paxton, but I was never thrilled with him even before his Tommy John. He just was never a guy I was interested in. When the Yankees were having problems with him, I was like, oh, thank goodness they're the ones having the problems, you know? So
yep.
It just, you know.
Would love to be wrong, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll own it. I have no issues with that. So here's how the rotation looks at the moment. And do I expect it to stay this way? Not necessarily, but do I expect it to change drastically? Also, not necessarily. So you've got, in some order, you know, it may not be this exact order. You've got Chris Sale. You've got James Paxton, Garrett Whitlock, Nick Pivetta, and Brian Bayo. Now, there's tons of risk here with Sale and Paxton. Like we said, they've pitched a combined 69 innings in the last 3 years because of their surgeries and setbacks and all that. 69 innings. They're both about the same age within a year. I think Sale might be, he turns 34, I think, just prior to opening day. For comparison, 39-year-old Charlie Morton has pitched 395 innings in that time frame. Sale and Paxton only, 69, like I said. So you got that issue going on. The issue for me with Whitlock is he's never done it for a full season at the big league level as a starter. He's one injury away from being an injury-prone player to me. I mean, has had elbow issues. I thought the hip issue was weird. I wouldn't think a pitcher in his 20s would have a hip issue, but it happened, and it took him out of the rotation last year. And I just don't – he doesn't look comfortable as a starter. He hasn't – I don't like his body language on the mound, and maybe some of that was probably due to the injury, but he just looks like he's stressed. He starts laboring. As he got into like his third, fourth, fifth starts, the strikeout rate just totally dropped when it was insanely high as a starter, as a reliever, I mean. The strikeout per nine anyway was through the roof. So you got that issue going on. I expect Bayo to be pretty solid. I'm actually the least pessimistic about him, but could he have some growing pains and an ERA around four, this season? Yeah, I think that's possible. And I do kind of worry about Tommy John with these young pitchers who have never had it. I mean, if he had it, in the minors or even in high school, I might be like, all right, well, that still buys him probably into his 30s, I would say. But he's never had it. And John Lester never had it. So you don't necessarily have to have it, at some point. But so there's, from either an injury-prone standpoint or a performance standpoint, there's tons of risk with this rotation. And I'm really uncomfortable with it.
I agree. I think you made a lot of great points. Just a couple of things to kind of piggyback on what you said. You said that they pitched 69 innings over the last 3 years.
Combined, yeah.
Combined. That still seems high. Like, if you were just to do, like, a mental, kind of, like, look back over the last 3 years, I would have taken the under on 69 innings. And it's crazy that they've even pitched that many, right? Because we just haven't seen these guys. I absolutely agree with you. That five does not make you comfortable, right? Because, Sale is a weird injury away, or a guy that's, had shoulder issues, kind of like you were mentioning with Paxton, right? How does the rest of the body that's not surgically repaired kind of deal with this stress load after not, kind of being under that duress for that many years? Houck picked up that injury covering first, right? He kind of had like that weird slip going to first base, and then just the hip was never the same.
Whitlock, you mean? Yes.
Or Whitlock, sorry. Yes. Yeah. Houck had the back injury.
I think it was a situation like that.
What was really interesting to me, and I don't know if like maybe Whitlock was adamant about being a starter, but they never let Houck go more than five. They wouldn't let him get through the third, get through a lineup a third time, yet they would always pull Whitlock before, the fifth inning, right? He would give us four scoreless at the beginning of the season before, his K rate dropped and he started to labor a little bit more. Maybe it was because of that injury. I don't know why they flip-flopped those guys. I think if we do a season retrospective and we look at the beginning of the season, you could point out to half a dozen to maybe even a dozen games that we could have won if we just had a competent eighth and ninth inning starter, and Houck was very easily giving us those six outs, no problem, six up, six down, shut the door. Does the season last year look a lot different if we get off to a better start, if we don't have that atrocious April and May combination? That to me was always something that I thought was a little bit peculiar. I don't know if that came from the front office. I don't know, what was kind of driving that conversation, but Bayo, I think we kind of had an inverse on what you normally see with players, especially on the pitchers. There's not a lot of tape on them coming up from the minors, and they, usually have kind of a flash in the pan at the beginning of their careers. And then, you know, obviously quickly big league hitters do big league hitter stuff. And they kind of figure out the weak points, figure out, you know, oh, this guy's got two good pitches. If I can stay off the third, we're fine. And then they get kind of beaten up. He was kind of the inverse, right? When he first came up, he was getting hit all over the yard. He wasn't putting innings away. He was, you know, walking batters. And then he really kind of found his stride and had a great close to the season. You know, the book's still out on what it's going to be moving forward. Is he going to be that four ERA guy, or is, you know, is he going to be somebody that we can count on to take the ball every fifth day? Only time will tell, right? Even the best speculations can't really tell us anything at this point, just because we only have seen so little from him. But yeah, I, you know, with those two guys at the top, in Paxton and Sale, I think we're going to see the Seabolds, the Crawfords, and the Winkowskis more than we're comfortable with at the very least, right?
Exactly.
You know, those guys came up, they gave us some good spot starts here and there. They gave us some bright spots in what ended up being a lost season. But if you're relying on them to turn, you know, the rotation over to the top again, I think we're going to be in a bad position, and it's going to look like last year all over again. And I don't know if we as a fan base can endure that two consecutive years.
Yeah, and I saw a tweet from Chris Cotillo, who, you like him or not, he seems to be the most connected Red Sox beat writer, has the most sources and all that. He says the Red Sox still aren't out on Rich Hill, even. Like, he could still come back. So it's just madness. When are we going to go back to those 2010 and even early 2000s rotations that we had, where you had at least two guys in there that were, you know, like a Lester and Lackey, two grizzly veterans that could just hold it down. You know what I mean? So because we kind of did touch on it, the bullpen situation is perplexing to me. Now, I was kind of resigned to Whitlock going into the rotation. There was a lot of talk about that. I was not expecting to find out today that Houck could also go into the rotation. So what's concerning here is you're looking at a complete rebuild of that bullpen. Like, I just can't imagine a bullpen not having one of the two of them in there, because both of them were nails at that role. And I ended up liking Houck more in that role in the long run. I talked about Whitlock's body language. You know, when things would get stressful, he'd be having traffic on the bases and all that. Not that he was terrible, but Houck would go in there just cool as hell and could handle it. And I think that's why Dennis Eckersley nicknamed him Cool Hand Luke, you know? So now, not only am I uncomfortable with the rotation, like, I just don't know where they're going to go with that bullpen. Are we going to start hearing Matt Barnes is going to get the ninth inning again? You know, he had a...
Please, no.
He had a decent finish, but he's just never going to do it for a full season. So, it's crazy. And you look at all the previous... Well, I shouldn't say all the previous, because the last few years have been interesting, but generally, In recent Red Sox history, going back 15, even 20 years, you'd come into an offseason with like one area of the team that you kind of need to focus on, you know, and then maybe you'll supplement like one player. You'll go get an outfielder or something to address that. Coming into 2023, you need two of everything, at least. You need two key bats. You need two key relievers, probably three or four at this point. And before today's news, I'm thinking you need two solid guys in that rotation. And I just don't get it. I don't understand the bloominomics, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and, you know, and this is the caveat being that, you know, we don't re-sign Eovaldi or Waka, right? You know, both guys are in talks and in negotiations. And I think, you know, this front office has shown that they're going to, you know, take it down to the wire with those deals, which is a bummer. But, you know, if we get one of those guys, I think we feel...
Well, actually, real quick, the qualifying offers have to be issued at some point on Thursday. I don't know if that's noon or 6 p.m. There's a deadline on Thursday. So anyone that's going to get one, those have to be dealt out by then. So those are the two more likely guys that could get one. And we covered that in the last show. I want no part of Eovaldi. That fastball dropped, you know, too much for my comfort. And I think there's too many red flags. I'd love to have Waka, but.
I think if you had to pick one, I think Waka is the safer moving forward. Sorry for the background noise. My pup's got some thoughts on the rotation as well here. But yeah, I think you nailed it right on the head, right? You know, we have a lot to worry about this with this rotation, with this bullpen, with, you know, with this lineup, and having this many spots to fill is going to be a tall task. And it's something that's going to make or break it for Bloom, right? It's either going to be general manager of the year, or, you know, we're looking at somebody different in 2024.
Yeah. And I think that's what it's going to come down to. I think he's going to completely lose the confidence of ownership if he can't put a formidable team out there. And an extra team gets into the playoffs now. So theoretically, it's easier than ever to get in. And if we're not doing it, it's crazy. And I don't see any team in this division taking a major step back. I think the Orioles are going to spend money. I think the Rays are going to be the Rays, you know, 85 to 90 wins, which probably is good enough for that last wild card. Yankees will find a way to compete. You got to go back to what, at least maybe the early 90s or some point in the 80s when they had a losing record, been below 500. They just never fall below that. And it's insane because we're either upper 90s or somewhere in the 70s, it seems like. Toronto is just too good to, I mean, there's just too much talent on there to really fall out of it. I think we can all agree they underperformed last year for the roster that they did have, but the division's not getting any tougher. We do play less divisional games because we're going to play every National League team now. So it's they call that a balanced schedule. So I think instead of 19 or 20 games against the divisional opponents, it's going to be around 14 games apiece, which I'm kind of in favor of. But I just, going back to it, this could be Bloom's last year. And for all the, I call them the Bloominati, for all the Heim Bloom huggers, y'all better hope David Stearns gets a job this winter. Because if not, he's prime time for the Red Sox, a team like the Red Sox, to scoop up at some point, maybe the middle of this season. It seems like when GMs get fired, it happened with Sherrington and it happened with Dombrowski. It's always after the trade deadline. So,
yeah.
August is go ahead.
I don't think I would necessarily call myself a Bloominati, nor would I call myself, you know, somebody that's looking to move on from him. I'm kind of in the middle at this point, just because I recognize kind of where the organization was contractually going into his tenure. I was definitely very disappointed with the way that this trade deadline came and went. You know, I thought, you know, we needed to make one decision or another, right? We can't just stay on the fence like we did. We, you know, made marginal improvements and we didn't, you know, gain any necessarily flexibility, nor did we acquire any prospects. So, you know, if we were to continue to stack treading water offseason, treading water deadlines, then, you know, then I'm going to start to kind of get on this guy a little bit more. But I like what he's done in the sense of trying to give us that flexibility moving forward, trying to get off of some of these big contracts, get, you know, out from underneath some of this dead money. But, you know, I think this is something you might have mentioned in the war room. You know, it's a lot of dumpster diving. It's a lot of these reclamation projects that he's trying to, you know, hope that we hit for a home run. And a couple more bounce the wrong way, and, you know, I could see him being shipped out of here as well.
Yeah, and, you know, I run the social media accounts, and I'm always playing patty cakes with all the haters, and a lot of them will accuse me of rooting against Bloom, you know, for the sake of it, because I want him to fail. But the truth is, and this is kind of a behind the scenes take that I have, we can't, as a podcast, we want to grow. You know, we want the listenership to grow. And last year we were flat. We were flat because we were a bad team. We didn't take that step forward. Just fans weren't into it. They had tuned out the Red Sox. And, you know, part of tuning things out is you don't listen to podcasts. So I want this team to win the division next year with Chaim Bloom, you know. So if I come across negative and throw the term Bloominati around a lot, I'm still rooting for this team to you know, do well. And he's got the most money he's ever had to spend. Arguably, he's got the most trade capital, whether he's willing to do it or not. I mean, he loves his farm. That's his baby. So who knows if he's going to deal from it. But he's got more prospects to deal if he wants to do it. And so if he can't do it this year, if he can't get us to at least 90 wins, there's no reason for me to believe he's going to do it next year or the year after that, you know? So if he can't get it done this year, and this will be the fourth time in 5 years, the Red Sox didn't make it to the postseason. If you count 2019, that was still a Dombrowski year, but so he's gotta show us something. And I dug up an old tweet that I had, and it was right after Bloom got hired, and I said I love the hiring, you know. And I was saying on the podcast at the time, when we're looking for a new GM, go look at Tampa, go look at Houston, go look at the Dodgers. Those are the smart organizations that develop the most talent, and it ended up being in our case the Rays. So another interesting thing here, we'll get to Xander and then we'll wrap it up. James Click, the GM for the Houston Astros, and obviously that's where you are, so you're deeply embedded into that territory. He might either resign or get fired after winning a World Series. That's the crazy thing, because he and Jim Crane, the owner of the Astros, don't see eye to eye. And
apparently, both Click and Dusty only get 1 year extensions after winning a World Series.
They did, yeah. And in the Click extension, apparently not official yet. They're still talking about it. Dusty Baker has accepted a 1 year deal, and I kind of get it with him. He's 74, and this is a really taxing thing. You saw it with La Russa; he had heart problems by the end of the year. So year to year for him is fine. And now that he's got his ring, I don't think he even cares. But in Click's case, apparently he had a potential trade worked out last season at some point to get Contreras from the Cubs. So the best catcher you could possibly acquire at the deadline. And Jim Crane stepped in and said, no, we're not going that way. And I don't know if, oh, he didn't want to give up Jose Urquidy, I guess. That was the big thing. So that was going to be the guy that got moved in the deal. And as we found out, all the pitching staff loves pitching to Maldonado. You know, he's their David Ross, and that's who they want to pitch to. And I kind of get it. And they ended up getting Vasquez without giving us Urquidy. Not that I mean, I guess that wouldn't have been a bad piece to get, but they ended up getting Vasquez. And the interesting thing to me in that deal was he didn't see nearly as much pitching time. And I think Dusty preferred Maldonado. And I think Dusty and Jim Crane kind of go behind James Click's back. And so Vasquez didn't get utilized. For the prospects we got, which were significant, they didn't utilize him nearly as much as you thought they might for giving up the, I don't know if you want to call it a haul, but the decent prospect package that we got. So just kind of weird there. And it's crazy to me. I mean, he sounds like he's a very difficult owner to work for. And Click also comes from Tampa. So he probably worked side by side with Heim Bloom even. Mm-hmm. He got hired. It was either later that off season or maybe it was the year after. I can't remember, but so that's something to watch. I don't see why Click should have to settle for a 1 year deal, you know?
And especially as well as Houston has been built for what, going on 6-7 years now, it seems like the next guy's up is always better than the guy that he's replacing, right? Like, I mean, obviously I know Click hasn't been there for the entire time of that stretch run, but I mean, maybe we can do something like the Celtics did, right? You move Brad Stevens off the floor into a front office position, and then you bring in another voice and the team gets running. I don't know what that necessarily looks like in the front office here for the Red Sox, but maybe it could be something. Interesting enough, I believe it was Vasquez that caught the no-hitter in the World Series, yeah?
Was it Vasquez? I think it was, actually. Yeah,
yeah.
The combined no-hitter.
A little feather in his cap.
Yeah, and even before that, pitchers had only given up like 2 runs in like 30 innings with him catching, so... And the crazy thing to me was that was my big criticism of Vasquez coming into this recent season, was that he was a terrible game caller and pitchers always had high ERAs. That's why you had Chris Sale always pitching to Sandy Leone. Like, he had to pitch to Leone. And I think Eovaldi also preferred not pitching to Vasquez. And suddenly, I don't know what changed, but everybody pitches extremely well to Vasquez. So, all right. So final topic, we'll probably spend at least 10 minutes or so on this. It's a deep one. In regards to Xander Bogaerts. So Scott Boras, and I should probably for the casual fans explain who Scott Boras is. He is the rock star. He's the rock star agent in MLB. If you're a good player, you want Scott Boras, cause he's probably going to get you the most money. And that means owners hate him because they're like, oh man, if he's involved now, you know. And JD Martinez got traded from the Tigers to the Diamondbacks, hit 28, 29 home runs in those last 2 months, got the Diamondbacks into the playoffs. Season ends, he fires his agent and then hires Scott Boras. So you see that a lot. I think Carlos Correa actually did the same exact thing, and there's actually... I think there might have been a lawsuit between Correa and his previous agent over the firing. But so the hardcore fans are going to be very familiar with Boras. But if you're a casual fan, that's who he is. And Scott Boras is the agent for Xander Bogaerts. And one of the things all the writers and baseball media look forward to with the GM meetings that are happening right now, every general manager, every top executive for every team is in Las Vegas right now, kind of meeting with each other, probably laying the groundwork for some trades that might happen in the coming weeks. They can also meet with agents. Sometimes even players show up. I heard Tommy Pham is out there because he lives there and he's just kind of making an appearance saying, hey guys, don't forget about me. You know, I'm still, you know, I can still play at the major league level. But the one thing they look forward to, I always take the long way to get there. Boras always holds court in the lobby of the hotel and basically has his impromptu press conference every year with the beat writers. He had that this afternoon. And this is a comment he had about Xander Bogaerts. He says, quote, "This is the first time teams have had the opportunity to sign the X-Man. They are finding it a marvelous opportunity." End quote. So he's you know, boosting the, he's hyping up Xander, you know, trying to attract the attention of teams. So what are your thoughts on that? What, because Bogaerts, like I said in the last show, he's not on the roster right now. He opted out. He is not a member of the Boston Red Sox. If you look up that 40 man, his name isn't on it. So what are your thoughts about him officially on the market and those comments from Boras?
I mean, it's the exact opposite of, you know, kind of what we had said about Paxton's handling, or Boras's handling of Paxton, right? You know, Boras kind of snuffed out the market and pretty much said, hey, we're going to take that $4 million player option. We'll be back. He's the most comfortable here, even though, you know, comfortable where? We haven't seen him. My thoughts are really, you know, what is Boris supposed to say at this point, right? You know, do I see a 7, 8, 9 year deal for Xander out there? No, I don't. But he's going to do his best to try to find that for his guy. You know, we've seen it time and again. He goes out there, he gets extra years, he gets additional AAV that we didn't see in the market, and it kind of comes in at signing close. You know, some guy gets a mega deal, and we're like, wow, you know, who was he competing against? Why did this team sign him for that value? You know, we've been talking about some numbers for Bogaerts, and you know, I think that, you know, 168, I think, is what we've seen on the ESPN article when they did the top 50 free agents and projected contracts. If I were Vegas, that seems like the number for me. I don't know if he goes over, if he goes under, I would have to sit there and I'd have to think a lot about that one. But, you know, Boris has always been the guy that, you know, pumps up his own clientele, makes everybody feel like he's got, you know, the dream team, the all-stars, you know, no bad representation for any of his guys. He's going to do whatever he can to try to get the most money for the guys in his team. And at this point in time, it's almost like you just have to tune it out and just say, hey, like, we got to look at this from a pure objective standpoint, you know, when it comes to Boris's clients.
A lot of good points there. For me, when you hear Boris talking like that, and he's going to get more aggressive with potentially other teams' executives than the Red Sox, he probably is trying to get the most money possible for Xander. And for anybody out there that's hardcore pro Xander, and I think that's most of our listeners, it's not me, as I've said. I mean, I'm not gonna go on a tirade if we do give him a big deal. But the thing I take from that comment is the Red Sox might have to win a bidding war, and I don't think that's the type of deal they really want. And to win a bidding war, what is that final number? Now, for anyone that wants a little bit of hope that the number might not be high, it is a deep market this year, and they're not all going to get mega deals. The only guy who got a mega deal last year was Seager, and that's because the Texas Rangers were dumb enough to do it. If they would have waited out the market, they probably could have signed him for less than the $325 million they gave him, which I think was a 12-year deal. So that's the interesting thing. And Carlos Correa was also a free agent last year, and Boris couldn't seem to land a mega deal for him. He did sign a 3-year, $105 million deal with the Twins, which was a good deal annually. It was a lot of money annually, but it was short term. So now I'm thinking, all right, well, now if he couldn't get that money, that huge long-term money for one of his players last year, how's he going to do it with two? Is the thing. And here's a good comp too. And if this would support him possibly coming to the Red Sox, maybe on, you know, not quite insane money. But if you go back to after the, let's see, it was right after the 2013 season with Jacoby Ellsbury, he got his deal fast. Like, he was one of the first free agents to come off the board. Yankees offered him, it was $152 million over 7 years, I think. And I thought, wow, that was quick. I thought Ellsbury would sit out there a little while. And it was obviously that was a high offer. I thought that was a bit of an overpay, especially with his injury history and stuff. But Boris took it. It was a good deal. So maybe it could be a matter of taking the first 160 or the first 175 that gets thrown Boris's way. He's going to be like, Xander, take it, because it's going to be a insane market, and that number might go down in the coming days. So I think for me, the number, I'm looking at the Marcus Semien deal last year that the Rangers had, where that was 175 over 7. So that's 25 per. That would be a $5 million raise annually in for 7 years. So that's kind of where I'm thinking it would top out with Xander. But yeah. And one other thing, though, with that Ellsbury deal, Scott Boras was actually Jacoby Ellsbury's agent. And the part of the reason I was surprised also that Ellsbury got 152 was he was injury prone. He didn't have a ton of power outside of that kind of shady 32 million, thirty-two home run season where he never hit more than like I think 12 after the before or after that. But so he didn't have a ton of power. He notoriously never had a great arm out there. He didn't have a cannon like Mookie and Bradley, and even Benintendi had a decent arm. So there weren't a ton of reasons to justify Ellsbury getting that deal, but Boras came up with a term, a Borasism, for lack of a better term. He said Ellsbury had prestige value, and he cited he comes from an organization that wins, won a couple of rings, so he had prestige value, and that's why he's worth a big deal. And the Yankees were the first sucker, and they gave it to him, and it didn't work out well. And as soon as they got Stanton, you basically never saw Ellsbury again. He was on the injured list, I think, for 2 years, and then they cut him.
We haven't seen him in public.
I know. It's like
since then. I mean, like anytime there's an Ellsbury sighting, like the whole internet peeks its head up. Like, wait, oh, he's still alive. Okay, cool, good to know.
And, you know, I think he's been at a couple of Red Sox ceremonies. He might have even been – Remy got honored, like, a bunch of times in the last handful of years, and I think he was at one of those. So So he would come out of that little garage door there in center field that they would all come out, and he'd be, like, one of at least 15 players. And It's just always goofy seeing a Red Sox player that – had gone to the Yankees and now come back. It's just weird seeing them back in that jersey. I almost get mad. I don't want to see Johnny Damon in a Red Sox jersey anymore. And I don't want to see Wade Boggs in a Red Sox jersey. I couldn't believe they retired his number, but you know, so when they come back and they put our jersey on, I'm just kind of, it just looks a little dirty to me, but you're right though. He just completely disappeared. He's just not a social media guy like you see with Middlebrooks and Papelbon was the same way until this very past year. Just completely, he choked out Bryce Harper, didn't choke him out, but they had the altercation. He got cut shortly after that and then never played again, never was on social media. It's like, where did he go? Did he go into the witness protection program? Did Harper try to have him whacked? I'm being facetious, but yeah, and he resurfaced, but you see nothing with Ellsbury.
I think Ellsbury gets a pass in the eyes of the Red Sox because he took that 7-152 from New York and pretty much just robbed them blind. I think if he had gone to New York and had a better tenure, kind of like Damon did, because I think Damon was part of that 09 team for
New York, right? And he had a great year that year. Yeah,
that, that makes it sting a little bit more. But, to see Ellsbury put all of his good years here in a Red Sox uniform, I mean, you mentioned it, right? Had 1 year of good power, which I still argue he should have been the MVP that year. I don't, one of my hot takes is pitchers shouldn't be able to win MVPs even if they have great seasons.
I don't disagree with that.
Verlander was incredible that year. I'm not taking anything away from Verlander. Absolutely should have won the Cy Young. But yeah, no, Ellsbury had that one great season of offensive production. But, he's a menace on the base paths. He's great defensively, but he doesn't have a great arm. And New York just... maybe he killed New York enough times where they're like, look, if we take the thorn out of our side and put it, on our rose, maybe it'll be better. And it just never panned out that way. So,
yeah,
he's got a soft spot in my heart.
And it's funny because you mentioned Damon, and that was painful when he went to New York. That was painful. None of us wanted to see that. We wanted to keep him. And he had only signed a 4 or 5 year deal, so it was a little bit more manageable. And when Ellsbury gets the deal with New York, I feel like everyone was okay with it. They're like, all right, is what it is. Let's move on. We were all resigned to the idea that we weren't signing him. So
definitely not for that much either.
Yeah. And yeah, and he also awkwardly, the 2013 team, which won the World Series, that was his last year. That was the Fear the Beard team. They all grew beards, and Ellsbury was the last one to do it. He didn't want to do it. And it was more of a goatee type thing, but he got on board and was trying to be, you know, a team player. So it is what it is. And I like Ellsbury, and I don't really hold a lot against him. That time he stole home on the Yankees, I think that was on Sunday night ESPN. That was great. I love that. That was in 2009. You know, I thought we had a potential World Series team that year, but we kind of faded late, and then the Angels swept us. Lackey, ironically, was part of that Angels team that shut us down. And then we signed him, which didn't work out well for a few years until, you know, that 2013 season. But yeah, so... So Boris just making interesting comments there on Xander. It's going to be a weird market. I don't think all those guys are going to... I'd be surprised if even two of them get over 300. And if they did, it's probably Turner and Correa that do it. But Charlie has this hot take on Correa every time. He's like, Correa's never hit 30 home runs. He's never had more than 100 RBIs, and he's right, but his numbers are typically across the board pretty good, and he's a very good defender as well. So, but yeah, he hasn't been injured in the last 2 or 3 years, but he definitely had issues before. And he had that, remember that injury with the masseuse? He like cracked a rib or something and blamed it on a masseuse.
Yeah, that was strange.
One of my favorite comments was, I don't know if it was on a passing tweet, but somebody comments underneath, goes, was the masseuse an elephant? You know, it was just like, yeah. It's funny how they lie sometimes about their injuries. And then we have Chris Sale, who doesn't lie. He's like, yeah, I fell off my bike. But
I mean, there's no faker injury in baseball than an oblique strain, right? I mean, oh, guys scuffling.
Yeah.
He gets, you know, oblique's a little tight. Need a 15-day stint in the minors.
Yeah. I will say, though, the rib injury to Sale is kind of curious to me. That one, because when do you hear of a pitcher cracking a rib throwing a pitch? And he's a freak. I mean, he's not built like any pitcher we've ever seen. You know, he's a stick man, and so maybe it is possible, but I'm just wondering, perhaps maybe something did happen there. And of course, and then it was downplayed at the time, and then it ended up being,
yeah, they kind of try to tuck that one in there and just like keep it moving on like on a news dump.
Yeah, exactly. And you're exactly right. It was right at the end of the press conference that day for Bloom. He goes through everything and he's like, oh, by the way, yeah, Sale rib injury. We don't know much yet, but he's not going to be ready for opening day, they said. And yeah, we finally got him in, what, September? Something like that for five? No, not even. Oh, was that his first start? I think it was his second start when he...
I think it was his second start, yeah.
Yeah,
because it was one of those things, because like he couldn't put batters away in the first start, but he got through it. And in the second start, it was like, oh man, you know, like he had a couple of ground balls that should have been outs but weren't, and then because that they didn't get out of that inning, he ended up getting the fastball or the comebacker off the hand.
There were two guys on base, but he wasn't sharp. You know, he was not. So that's why I'm a huge pessimist. I think with him, you're going to see more of that, and there's going to be chirps. Oh, put him in the bullpen, and the Red Sox will let him get killed 6 or 7 more times out there, and then they'll finally stubbornly agree. But yeah. Well, all right, we'll wrap on that. We could potentially be back, I don't know, maybe tomorrow night or the next night or whatever, to discuss any other developments. The GM meetings are going on, and today is the first of the 3 days that they're out there. So that's why we got all these nuggets and ended up coming on Hope everyone's having a good week, and we'll see you really soon. Probably the next 24, 48 hours. Take care.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.